of them. Vivian was only 13, but she died a few months later. Like a widow who's lost her beloved husband, she went from perfectly healthy to departing this earth within 4 months. She simply could not live without him, and her health deteriorated rapidly. We put her down to the sounds of Nick Drake in the garden. We all sat around, and the doctor administered the shot to close her eyes and end her unthinkable pain. We all held her and tried to make it as beautiful and safe as it could be. Everyone who she touched sat hand in hand in a circle around her. I put Templeton and Vivian's ashes together on a giant rock that goes all the way out to the water in Malibu Beach, where these two ran up and down for 13 years. They would live forever in a spot that made them happy. Again, all my friends gathered for the ash-throwing ceremony, and as we said our goodbyes as the sun set over Vivian and Templeton's rock, we read the profound eulogy Eugene O'Neill wrote for his dog, called The Last Will and Testament of Silverdean Emblem O'Neill. No matter how deep my sleep, I shall hear you. And not all the power of death can keep my spirit from wagging a grateful tail. One giant wave came over it as we were all saying goodbye. Was it them? I can only hope. Back at home, Flossie was exercising her third act. Now, as the star of the show and with no disrespect to her brother and sister, she had the floor and a new glint in her eye. It was by no means evil, just slyly content to have the calm and quiet around her. She could just be as she always was, just an old movie star diva in her own spotlight. And so, just the two of us now, older, slower, calmer, we were both entering profound phases in our lives. When Flossie and I came together, I was 19 and very much a kid. However, she taught me how to care for someone and grow in such a way that I could have never become the nurturing person I am today without her. My ability to take care of something and someone developed with her. She gave me so much in return. I was so content with her. I never felt alone. But now I was 35 and Flossie was almost 17. I spent most of my days at home with Flossie. I could feel she was winding down. One night, I said goodnight to her. She had recently made a habit of staying downstairs at night. I kissed her goodnight, and I went up to my room. I woke up the next morning and walked down to where she was. She was facing the other way, and I knew she was gone. Peacefully, in her sleep, she went to the angels, and I held her with tears streaming down my face. There was nothing I could do or say to this fluffy shell that housed a soul that meant so much to me. She had made me whole in this world, my silent partner, my old world friend. This was my third time to go through this process, and I had found these wonderful people who came to collect the dog's remains and also cremate them and give you the ashes in a meaningful dog-themed urn. I held her until they came. I said goodbye one last time and slumped down on the floor. To say that I was lost is the understatement of the world. After a few light-headed hours of feeling like I had been staring into the sun, I got an idea. I picked up the phone and called my travel agent, and when she picked up, she asked how I was. I burst into tears and told her what happened. I knew she would be empathetic, and she gave me her utmost condolences. I said thank you. She asked, how can I help? And then I cleared my throat and I took a breath and said, I want to go to India. She asked me for my time frame, and I said I wanted to go as soon as Flossie's ashes were back with me, probably in a day. All right, she said, let's get a plan. And so I did. I took Flossie to India and gave her a fitting send-off. The first place I spread some of her ashes was at Gandhi's house in New Delhi. Then I took her to a Buddhist monastery way up in the Himalayas. And third, I put the rest in the Ganges River off a quiet path in the countryside. I thanked her over and over for her companionship. There is a hole in my heart ever since she has been gone. However, I try to make her proud with all the love that I try to give every day to my girls. Flossie was my first girl, and the love I felt for her is one of the best gifts I have ever known. I took a small portion of the ashes back to that old rock in Malibu, and hopefully the old band is back together. The three musketeers of dogs I felt so lucky to care for. And I did care for them so very much. I have two dogs now, and because of the kids, I fear that they get the short end of the stick with attention compared to the red carpet I rolled out for Flossie, Templeton, and Vivian every day of their lives. Don't get me wrong. There are toys and treats and love all around. It's just more of a traditional dog-to-human relationship and not the profound bond I was used to. My whole world was those dogs. And every extracurricular moment was spent conjuring up our next great adventure. I am now turning to my two daughters instead, saying, "What do you want to do today?" with a big smile and a "Let's go" cadence. But I love that my girls are growing up with dogs. We have Lucy, the white shark, as Olive calls her when we are all swimming, and Douglas, the scrawny, long-legged mutt with the heart of gold. He's neurotic, but truly lovable. The house is chaos sometimes when the dogs are trying to eat the kids' food or jumping into the tub with them, but it's worth it. Life with dogs is better. I just wouldn't have it any other way. They say that dogs can give and receive love through their eyes. The unspoken ability to lock in and actually feel love between human and animal is an extraordinary thing. And we shared many looks of love, me and my girl. Domestic bliss. I am engaged. I am 5 months pregnant. I can't make pancakes. On this particular Sunday morning, I woke up a little cranky. I had a huge zit, and my hair was totally damaged from dyeing it blonde. Not to mention I was wearing farmer jeans due to my protruding stomach. After sitting in the sun, brushing my hair and petting the dogs, I came into the kitchen and read the New York Times. And then I had the bright idea. I know, I'll cook some pancakes. I had just gotten a new recipe for lemon ricotta pancakes, and I thought, this Sunday morning would be the perfect time to attempt it. Cooking had become my latest obsession. I had traded going out to concerts and late-night dinners for a stay-at-home lifestyle. Instead of running around in my 30s like I was still a teenager, I was settling down with my new garden and my new cookbooks and trying to play the part of the character I have never been able to master. The grown-up. I thought that herb boxes and homemade meatballs were the gateway to maturity. I had an electric pepper mill, which seemed pretty advanced to me. I fantasized about being the woman who could whip up anything in her kitchen. Instead, I am now stretched over cookbooks with a look of concentration on my face, with no freedom in my step, still working out a lot of kinks in my very spotty cooking. For instance, my fiancé is puking upstairs as we speak, and it's from my lemon ricotta pancakes. Here's what happened. First, I started separating the egg whites. The recipe said to do that and then whip them up into a mountainous shape. So I did. I didn't have a mixer, so I did it by hand and arm. I wanted to cry in pain after 10 straight minutes of whipping, but when the liquid started to become peaks, I was thrilled. Then it said to take 4 egg yolks. Fuck! I threw those away. Okay, breathe. Just go get 4 more. I had now murdered almost a dozen eggs. Not ideal, but I obviously hadn't considered the next step enough, so it's my fault. Okay, now I had separated out the yolks, and this time I saved the whites. Not going to be a chump again. Will I need them? Who knows? But in a bowl on standby is better than in the trash. Step 2. Add sugar, flour, and ricotta cheese and lemon zest. So I did. I carefully measured everything like a meticulous baker, and I put it all into a bowl, ready to mix. Fuck! I didn't read that you are supposed to mix the eggs and the sugar and the ricotta, then add the flour. No wonder this was sticky. Feeling guilty about wasting food, I realized that I would have to waste 4 more eggs to get it right and do it all over. Resigned to the waste, wanting this to be great for my man, I started cracking the eggs. There were only 3. No 4th egg. Okay, fine. I would attempt to adjust the other ingredient ratios. Not something I ever feel comfortable with. 3/4 is exactly 1 egg less or a quarter. What? I didn't know how to measure that. Okay, breathe again. Be free, I told myself. It's only pancakes. So I trimmed the sugar, I trimmed the ricotta, and of course, flustered, I just started zesting the lemon haphazardly into the bowl. I started mixing it with the eggs, and to my surprise, it was a good consistency. Okay, this was all making sense. And the flour should mix with this nicely to make something that resembled batter rather than mortar. Great. I poured in the flour and it started thickening. Then thickening. Then too thick. Fuck! I forgot to do 1/4 less on the flour. I started throwing spoons. My fiancé at the time, Will, came downstairs and instead of finding some sexy brunch-making lady, he found a hissing child. Don't come near me right now, I said. He has the tendency to want to get involved, and that's the last thing I wanted right now. I'll be over here, he said as he headed to the couch and started reading the leftover paper. Standing over the sink, I just felt lost and stupid. I looked at the counters, and it was just a giant mess. I sucked in every way, and the evidence was everywhere. It was all a sprawling avalanche of every bowl in my cabinet filled with the wrong mixtures and flour and spills and splats of eggs and sugar, not to mention the 10 spoons and whisks and wooden spoons lying like dead carcasses. I was going to make this work no matter what. Okay, now what? Well, I heated up the skillet and decided to pour or better yet, thwack my batter into the pan and start cooking it. At least I figured I could get what the flavor profile was trying to reveal. As the butter started melting and the batter started cooking, I could smell something positive. I got a moment of encouragement. Maybe these wouldn't be right, but they might be edible. Now, I need to mention a side note that the last time I made pancakes for my man, they were old-fashioned, they were blueberry, and they were raw. He was very nice about it, but it was my goal this time to at least take that screw-up out of the equation by simply cooking them through. The bottom was browning nicely on my current pancake, and I flipped it on over. Looked good. Okay! Let it cook all the way this time, I said to myself. And I did. And then I flipped it onto a plate, poured a little syrup on it, and served it to my little taster. He started in on his first bite. I was tense. He looked up and smiled. "It's good." I felt relieved. "And you know I'd tell you otherwise," he said. And it's true. He would. As much as I want to kill him when he does tell me he doesn't like something, I am always grateful when he does like something because I know it's genuine. And I hate yes men. I like it real, honest, tough love with support. And of course, when you earn praise, it feels sweeter than ever. "So one more pancake?" I wanted to ask. Because if he said no, then I wouldn't know what to think. But instead, he asked for another before I could even speak. And I started happily slopping some more paste onto the frying pan. On about the fourth one, I started really getting it right. Size, color, taste. But by then he was full and the best one of the bunch sat there on the plate. I looked down at it with a sense of pride and thought that I would always give him the later pancakes from now on because the kinks will have been worked out and that is the level of service I would like to provide my customers. I turned around and looked at the destruction I had wrought on my kitchen. And instead of cleaning up, I just sat down for a minute thinking, this should never have taken so much out of me. Breakfast is not supposed to wear you out both physically and emotionally. But there I was, slumped on the kitchen table. I slowly started reading the newspaper again. All of a sudden, Will got up from the couch quickly and said, "What did you put in those pancakes?" with a very panicked and pained look on his face. "Oh God, what have I done?" Eggs, ricotta, I started listing things off, and then I said, "Nothing bad, why?" And he said, "I think I have to throw up." And he started off to the upstairs bathroom. As I sat there in the kitchen, wide-eyed, I heard a small whisper from the stairs. "I think they were raw." His voice trailed off and the door shut behind him. Well, I think to myself now, domestic bliss may be one thing, but domestic goddess, you are not. Jumping ship. In 1982, I met my friend Mel, full name Melissa Bochco, at a John Denver celebrity ski tournament in Aspen, Colorado. My mom, in classic fashion, befriended her mom, and then when we returned back to Los Angeles, where we all lived, she would bring me to Mel's house for a sleepover and then show up again 3 days later to pick me up. This happened a lot. But Mel and I stuck together and stayed friends way past childhood. In fact, we are still friends in our 40s with kids. But one day, when I was 19, we heard Mel's mom, Barbara, was going on this lavish boat trip through the Mediterranean, starting in Istanbul and making its way to the pyramids. It was a 3-week extravaganza, and frankly, looking back, we were not at our most sophisticated yet, but somehow we visualized ourselves sailing through ancient ruins and wonders of the world. Luxury on the high seas? I'm not sure what we were expecting. Steamer trunks and old-fashioned movie moments for me. Mel, I will never know. Mel is a salty, sharp-witted gal who causes most people when they meet her to leave with their tails between their legs because she is a cut-you-down-to-size kind of person. And even worse, everyone is laughing because she does it with such humorous flair. She has softened in her older age, and she is probably the most sensitive to those she cares for, yet she hasn't lost her edge totally, I am happy to say. But Mel is also known to stay around headquarters when we travel. She is the kind of person who would fly to New York for the night, go to her hotel room, sleep, and then fly home the next day. She sleeps in late and does her own thing. Yet, somehow, she's the person you want to hang with. I can't explain it. So we heard Barbara was going on this exotic expedition, and we petitioned her to take us with her. We said we would pay our own way. I had saved enough money and, well, Mel would be getting it from her parents as her mom's treat. However, Barbara would soon begin to feel like I was anything but a treat for her. When Mel and I showed up to meet the group, I was at that age where I had just come into my own body, so I was a non-bra-wearing, vintage-clothes-sporting gal who carried around a boombox that I had hand-painted rainbows and hearts and clouds on. I showed up with my serape backpack and super short blonde pixie hair, and I was, simply put, a 90s hippie. Mel, dressed in black, always in black, as if every day was a funeral in about 75-degree heat, showed up at the airport with me, and from the moment we stepped onto the plane, I could see the apprehension in Barbara's eyes. She knew what this trip was for her, a well-deserved lifetime experience at the age of 50-something, her kids finally old enough to rely on themselves, and her moment to take a personal break from it all. Enter us. On board the Lufthansa aircraft headed for Istanbul, we seemed to get the same look from our flight attendant. Skeptical. Don't get me wrong, Lufthansa is a wonderful airline, but in this moment we were being stereotyped as two young a-holes in business class. A kind of, how did you get this seat feeling? We just got the giggles, and sometime after takeoff and a few complimentary champagnes, Mel announced to me that she needed to take a Lufthansa, meaning she needed to have a bowel movement, and the laughter went from giggles to roaring. More sneers from the cabin crew. But you can bank on the fact that we still make the Lufthansa joke to this day. Again, great airline. We landed in Istanbul. It was 1994. And again, I was just not dressed for the environment. I immediately realized I had totally misunderstood the dress code. Not that I had anything in my arsenal that would have been more appropriate, but I was having that we're not in Kansas moment the minute we stepped off the plane. However, we proceeded outside to meet our greeter to take us to the boat. And as I walked out of the airport, I saw a giant tour bus. What the fuck? I was a 19-year-old semi-punk rebel, and I didn't do tour buses. I also started to rapidly clock the people gathering around the bus, and they were all Barbara's age at best. Oh my God. Mel and I had just stepped into a senior moment, and we were the black sheep, to put it mildly. So as we made our way onto the bus, I was already freaking out in my head. I hated organized things like this. Less corporate and more running naked through fields was my kind of journey, although I did not wish to run around naked in these parts. Even I knew that. We were handed itineraries, and I was looking at this dossier of everything being organized to the minute. We were to be ushered through every port and every destination. More sweat. We boarded the bus. They took us to a hotel to acclimate to the time zone and experience Istanbul as the first marvel of the expedition. Okay, great. As soon as we got to the hotel, I felt freer. For this day, everything was more relaxed and we were able to go through the bazaars and roam around. The senses delighted. Mel and I wanted to wander through the marketplaces. Barbara insisted we go look at rugs because she wanted an authentic Turkish rug to take home with her. When you're 19, you're not thinking of worldly possessions and anchoring a room with a memory-filled throw rug. You're not sitting with friends telling the story of how you handpicked this out of hundreds of rugs while drinking tea in the back room of a bustling shop. But here we were, me and Mel sitting cross-legged drinking tea. I just wanted a beer or something fun, but Barbara ordered us tea, and I didn't want to oppose her yet. The man proceeded for about 2 hours to unfold rugs in a fast fashion. He unfurled hundreds of them. Mel and I started humming circus music just to keep ourselves amused. I could not tell the difference from one rug to another, but there we sat, stuck until Barbara finally picked one. Good, I thought. Now we can finally leave. I am sure she was having her own thoughts about me, and they started to bubble when we went outside to see the light of day, and there was a pigeon park. Of course, at that time, I was a vegan animal rights activist. So when someone saw a rat with wings, I saw a bird of peace. And so I started feeding them. And they were so aggressive that they started to fly onto my arms and hands. I was loving every minute of it. The locals started to gather around in amazement, I thought, as if I looked like some bird whisperer. Mel said that they were probably laughing at me for being such an idiot to let these diseased things land all over me. The scene quickly turned Hitchcockian, and the spectacle of hepatitis meets inappropriately dressed American girl had the locals in a frenzy. I looked past the crowd to see Barbara's small face in the distance. Yep, she definitely was regretting letting us come. Day one. On the boat, I came aboard, and the truth was that this boat was beautiful. It was like a cruise ship. Slightly shrunken down, but very upscale. Since I had paid my own way, I started to feel my own sense of self, and I marched right up to my cabin, shared with Mal, and I unpacked, set up my boombox with loads of fresh batteries and my case of handcrafted hours-to-make mixtapes that were all decorated with stickers and Sharpie, each representing a different mood. There was the Cat Stevens-style one, the Roberta Flack one, and the Acid House remix one. All over the lot, and each one ready to spring to life to get the party started, or the wind down winding. I have zero gifts in the musical arena, but I have never lived life without an eclectic soundtrack. Life is better with music, although there is a certain class of jazz I still cannot eat to. It's too energized and spastic and not meant for digestion, but more of a birthing of the deepest inspiration and voracious call of the wild. I bring this up because I was becoming that for Barbara. I was quickly becoming something she could not digest to. And when I came into a room, it was as if an aggressive life-altering jazz kicked in at level 5. We would get to 10 soon enough. We set sail, and I threw on my new white 1940s ruched old-fashioned one-piece bathing suit I bought for the trip, and went up to the pool and ordered a frou-frou cocktail. I knew they wouldn't question my age. It was more of a marvel to them that I wasn't in my golden years like the other passengers. It was more, oh my God, she's young, rather than, wait, are you old enough? And so with that cocktail cherry being broken, I decided that drinking was going to be my lubricant into total toleration. Turning to Mel with my drink, I said, "This isn't too bad." Mel and I cheers as we left the first port. We sailed all night, and into the dining room we went for our first dinner. This was a serious white tablecloth atmosphere. Again, I had on a bright paisley poochie-like dress, unlike the elder ladies of the boat. Oh my God, this is going to be a long trip, I started to feel again, as Barbara walked in with her very sensible outfit, which resembled one large pashmina, and we all sat down. We were to eat at this table every night for the next 3 weeks. So when conversation ran out in the first 5 minutes, I excused myself and went walking around. And much to my surprise, I found a little casino room. Drinking and gambling? Yes, please! So from then on, I ordered one course for dinner and made my way out early every night and started hanging with the guys at the blackjack table and roulette wheel. I felt much more at home swapping stories with this diverse younger crowd, and I didn't feel judged. We actually all had interest in hearing each other's stories. Not to mention, I am a gamer through and through. It passed the time and was much more fun than staring at our plates in the dining hall. One of our first stops, after days at sea, was the Greek island Crete. The beautiful Mediterranean landscape truly spoke to me. I loved it. I looked up high on the mountain and saw the white buildings and the color of the sea that cannot be described in the way that it is light and dark all at the same time. It sparkles. It beckons. It is majestic. Today's activity was to get to the top of the mountain where the actual town was and go walking around, shop, and go see ruins. It was like following a herd while a woman told you the history of this and that as you flocked together. No free form. I started to grimace. When we all waited to get up to the top, I saw people mounting donkeys and starting their way up the winding hills. What? I was way too much of an animal lover to make this poor old donkey schlep my ass up this giant mountain. So, concerned for this creature's well-being, in protest, I said, I would just walk it. Barbara rolled her eyes, embarrassed that I would not just follow protocol, and as I started up the mountain, the guy shouted, Miss, it's too far! You must ride the donkey! I looked back smugly and said, I'm good! And I mumbled to Barb that I would see her at the top. She responded by giving half a head nod, as if to answer and yet not let on to anyone else that she knew me. Now, where was Mel, you ask? On the boat. Once again, in classic Mel fashion, she chose to sit this one out. She said there were many Greek islands to stop at, and she would see one, but for now she just felt like staying in. It didn't surprise me, and yet somehow it was forcing Barbara and me together more and more. Without the Mel buffer, it was not fun for either of us. Even though Barbara had known me my entire life, I was at that yucky age for her, and she was not in an age for me that I could relate to. We were at a biological impasse here in the islands of Greece. She mounted her donkey and passed me on the way up. I gave her a half-hearted wave. About an hour plus later, I reached the top. Now I understood why they have the guests ride the burros. My legs were simply jelly. They were so shaky that I could barely walk, and this was the start of the day when we were all supposed to walk around for hours. Oh, shit. I limped around in pain and counted the minutes till we could just get back on the boat and I wouldn't have to look interested in what our guide had to say. All I wanted to do was break off and go sit in a cafe and see local culture. But I went with the flock, and to Crete school we went. Luckily, I found a gondola that went down the mountain in another area and avoided the donkey and leg-breaking journey down. When we returned at sunset to the boat, there was Mel, unscathed and content. What did she do all day? The same thing she usually does. Be Mel. Just lie around like a lizard on a rock. Meanwhile, I was like a mad chimp hearing the next day's itinerary, and off I went to the casino with my people. The next week, we went to a mosque. Mel had decided to join this day. Maybe she even had a little cabin fever. As we entered the doors, Barbara wrapped herself up in a homemade burqa, and I looked down at my own attire. Baby t-shirt with no bra, corduroy bell-bottoms, and wacky platforms. Barbara and I made eye contact, and I could tell she thought I was a disrespectful idiot. I learned later it had said on the day's itinerary that the women should cover up. I treated that paper each morning like a wasteful tree killer and failed to learn about the dress code. So Mel, who dressed like she was going into a mosque in everyday life, managed to cover herself up in a passable way. I wrapped my backpack across my front and took off my shoes and found odds and ends in my bag to make do. As we went in, I started to cheer up because I love prayer. And here, I was in a faraway land, doing something I love in an amazing place. I was a student of the universe, asking for guidance in how to live, whether for the day or for life. Everything had fallen away, and yet when I opened my eyes, I saw Barbara looking at me in my tiny t-shirt that showed skin as I bowed down. God, I was a nightmare for this woman, and a nightmare to this house of worship. I couldn't take it. Just when I was feeling at one with the celestial planes, I realized that I was just someone else's idea of hell. We left the mosque and returned to the boat. Mel and I managed many giggles, but I was starting to get really depressed. For weeks this went on. Wake up, eat together, get on a bus together, learn together. No Mel, no break in the steps of the day's proceedings. And I was too young and stupid to take in the land. Instead, I was stewing in the formality of every moment being accounted for. It just wasn't me. I was a free bird, caged. I was coming to a boiling point. One day, the boat had docked off the coast and just allowed people to flow freely or simply relax at the pool. I don't know why, but it was a snow day on the Mediterranean for this overly organized group. I walked around, and instead of feeling free, I felt like this boat being stuck out in the water was my final straw. I could see land, but not get to it. And the promenading around the floating jail was not my idea of leisure. As Mel tells it, she and Barb were sunning by the pool when a boatman walked up to her with a pained and nervous face. They looked up from their books. Excuse me, ma'am, he said to Barb. I am so sorry to disturb you, but your friend has jumped off the boat. She looked at him, confused, as if he was saying the impossible in another language. Your friend has jumped off the boat and swum out to that little island, I'm afraid. Clearly, this had never happened. Barbara just went red. Mel, of course, made a hilarious joke of how they would retrieve me. We will put down one of the boats and go and get her, I suppose. I am very sorry. This is unprecedented. He looked apologetically at Barb. And it was true. I was on the top floor of this giant ocean liner, and something took over me. You know when you just start to psych yourself up? I was like, I could make that jump. I could. It's not high enough to kill me. I saw a very small island of just a giant rock out in the distance. I could swim that far, right? The height? The distance? The idea was too tempting. And with my heart pounding, double daring me, it crescendoed into me putting one leg onto the railing, climbing, then the other leg, and then I was at the top of the railing and just said, fuck it, and flung myself over a good 100 feet or so and plunged so deep into the water that I struggled to get up to the surface. But I did, and with that first gasp, I broke through and felt alive. The rebel was back! I immediately started off to the rock in the distance, and after about 30 minutes of swimming, I reached it. Panting and gasping, I pulled myself up out of the water and felt like, as much as I was about to die, I also never felt so alive. Ha 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 ha! You old fuckers! Look who's the bad girl now! They all looked at me like I was the Jezebel of the ship anyway. That tart that gambles and hangs out with the locals and dresses like a whore from 1972. Well, now I've proved you right! Ha! After the high wore off, in about 5 minutes, I realized I could not exactly set up camp and live permanently on this inhospitable rock. These people were my ride home. I slumped in defeat because I would have to return with my tail between my legs. And just then, I saw a dinghy in the distance making its way to me. I was half relieved, half terrified of facing Barbara. Maybe she was right. Maybe I was just a misguided, stupid, juvenile jerk who had made a series of mistakes in my life. One of the reasons I was eager to join this trip in the first place was that I had just married a guy I was dating, and I was also trying to help him with all his green card business, and the whole thing was a bust, and as good as my intentions were, he was a wreck and I was an idiot, and we immediately shook hands and filed for divorce. At 19, I had ruined the sacred nature of marriage. I had killed my career by 12. I needed a major reboot, and I had ideas, yet not a total grasp on how to do it. I was still strangely wearing the cheap band on my finger that was a temporary wedding ring. That night at sunset, as the boat was setting sail once again, I went up to the top deck and looked out at the water. I was a humble ant in the middle of the world, and I had so much to learn. I slipped the ring off my finger and realized and remembered that you can pray anywhere, and so I did. As the boat started to reach deeper waters, I told the beautiful, colorful sky that I wanted to learn from its all-knowingness, and that even though I was lost, I vowed to do whatever it took to find my way. I apologized for screwing up marriage already and for everything else I might have botched, but I vowed that I was no lost cause. I was worth it for this powerful Almighty not to give up on. Don't give up on me. The pink-orange sky sent me a breeze, and I threw the ring out, and it body-surfed its way into the deep blue sea. When I returned to the dining hall that night, much to my surprise, the guests thought it was hilarious that I jumped ship, and instead of turning up their noses or their backs on me, they asked me many questions about my escapade. All of a sudden, I was being let in rather than rejected. Even if they're amused more than anything, I'll take it, I thought. And with that, I finally had something to talk about with everyone. My stint AWOL gave us common ground, and it was the best night on the ship. I know even Barbara was relieved that I was a hit. I think she unpuckered for 5 minutes and actually felt good about my presence. Like, I know, she's always been a little wild, and, you know, since she was 7, she has always done things in her own way, etc. We ate dinner, and Mel and I made our way up into our cabin. I put on my mellow blues mix, and as the soulful song In the Pines by Leadbelly came on, we talked about cutting our losses and leaving early. I loved the idea of leaving on a high note, and the next day was the day we finally got to the pyramid, so as long as I saw that, I was happy to cut bait on this bitch and go home. As we pulled into Egypt, I entered the bus, practically high-fiving the old-timers. But Mel and I were secretly plotting our escape. We got on the hotel phone and made our reservations to get out of Dodge super early the next day. The boat would be continuing on, but we felt like our 3 weeks was enough. After completing what felt like a James Bond mission to get ourselves out of Egypt later that night, after the bus trip to the pyramids, we had time to kill, so we put the television on. We turned the dial on the TV and came across a Richard Pryor movie in Arabic. It wasn't Stir Crazy or one of the ones I knew well. It seemed to be about him and his family and their new house. That was all I could make of it before the phone rang, and it was the chipper guide to summon us to the bus. I hung up, grabbed my backpack, and said to Mel, "Okay, let's go see these pyramids we just traveled weeks to see." She was lying on her back, one arm under her head, lounge lizard position on the bed. And without looking up at me, she said, "I'm going to stay in the room." I looked at her with my big eyes and mouth agape. "What? It's the pyramids! This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Are you nuts? I mean, I knew she was, but come on." She looked at me and pointed her arm and finger. "I can see them out the window." I shook my head. Indeed, you could see them out the window, as we were clearly in the adjacent to the Sphinx Hotel specifically built for tourists. "Wow. Okay, I'm out." And with that, I left Mel to watch her Richard Pryor movie in a language she did not speak. Later that night, when I returned from staring at those pyramids and savoring my newfound lease on life, Mel and I made our way to the airport. It was honestly terrifying being two girls traveling through alone with all the men and their machine guns. At the airport, they were examining my boombox and were convinced it was some type of detonator. I begged and pleaded with them not to confiscate it. After being threatened, I backed down. But eventually, they gave it back. We waited as the men with machine guns looked at us like aliens. Our plane finally came in. It was a Lufthansa flight. We ran onto the flight and sank into our seats, and I immediately downed my complimentary champagne. As the cabin crew watched us once again, I thought, judge me all you want. Just take me home, please. The good news is we have all grown up a lot. Barb was there front and center when I got married a few years ago. I hope she no longer hates me. One day, I will be on a trip with one of Olive and Frankie's friends, and I can only hope they don't do to me what I did to Barb. Dear Olive, you are very smart. I know that according to the book Nurture Shock, I am not supposed to tell you that you are smart, but you are very sharp. Let's call it that. I have read many books and studied many things because I have always wanted to attack parenting in a very smart way myself. I am an overachiever in most areas of my life. I take on a lot, and I expect perfection in myself. I am hard on myself, and I'm sure some of that comes from fear. And I admit, I was scared when you came into the world because I just wanted to make sure that everything was perfect for you. It all started with your nursery, which was French magazine ready, and my approach to making sure everything was perfect and very dialed in, from your supplies to asking my sister-in-law for the right babysitters, to making sure your birth plan was all taken care of, complete with hospital room, the best doctors, and your grandparents there at the ready. But you didn't come. You were late. And I waited day after day. I should have known then that you would be teaching me incredible life lessons from the moment you were born. My birth plan? Not your plan. Okay, got it. You didn't even want to be the astrological sign you were supposed to be and waited 9 days and skipped right on in to your Libra nest. Those first few days in the hospital, I thought I would die from fear. Your weight was dropping, we were not sleeping, and I was ill, dizzy, completely spun out. I brought you home. The first drive was cliche-worthy, surreal, and fun. And when I brought you into this perfect room I built for you with your father, it was as if no one else in the world was there. It was just you and me and my concern with keeping you alive. This did not go away for the first 3 months. I wanted to control everything, make every bath the most amazing soundtrack event that ever existed. I think you are more musical for it, and you love to dance, so that's good. I was up for days on end. Eating and sleeping were just difficult because I was concerned about your sleep training and getting your bottle down and making sure you burped and that your room was dark, and don't get me started on the temperature of the room. I would stand there at the thermostat and tinker all day. I became like a bad sketch in a comedy show that wasn't even funny, but more a study in the decline of one's sanity. I showed you everything and explained everything. Red truck, yellow duck, the cow says moo. You could count to 10 by the time you were 1.5, and up to 20 by 2 years. It was amazing. You could name over 30 animals and spell and write your own name on your second birthday. You know how to communicate what you want. We have incredible conversations, too. You are not in turmoil because you can't truly express yourself. You flip out because you want, More Peppa Pig, like every other kid. You have always known what you needed. And funnily enough, you didn't need my worry. In many ways, though not purposely, I took a survivor approach. Not having a model and just wanting to make sure that you had consistency and classes and stimulation was important. Most of all, I wanted you to feel safe. I also tried to make you laugh all the time. And you are a semi-serious bird. You like it when you like it. Sometimes, seriously, is the look on your face, and other times, I melt you. You break, and you crack a smile, and you say, "Silly mommy." Come to think of it, there is an almost semi-patronizing quality to it, as if you know I am being a total goof. But I can't help it. I like to pander for laughs. It was even my job for a while. I am also a silly person when it comes right down to it. You take things very seriously, and again, for being only three, I cannot believe the things you say or the capacity of your comprehension of a situation. I am already contending with a developed mind. I can't wait for you to get into school. I want you to go all the way. I will do whatever I can to foster your journey, and I am glad to say that being an overachiever will serve you well. I know you like having so much knowledge at your disposal, and you use it well. You are still a kid, and you love to watch Cinderella five times over, and you love a play date, but even your art you take very seriously. It's great to watch. And we give you your supplies and watch you go. It's wonderful. It's also great to watch you read so much and say every page out loud and recite the books front to back and even say the author's names. It kind of freaks me out. But then again, I have no reference. I have no siblings and no real idea what the normal child development rate is. You just seem strong to me. Even when you get hurt, you don't want anyone to console you, and you don't want to be held. You want to fix it all by yourself. But, of course, I want to take care of you. I try to follow your rhythms, too. You are very self-aware, and at the end of the day, you need my strength and not my worry. You like it when I am very capable and know exactly what to do. This took me a while, but I am feeling much better now. I work with Seedlings Group and Safe Kids, both of whom have taught me so much, and I found a book called Raising Lions, which helped me find my strength as well. I am the parent, period. I know I will have to keep researching and learning and experiencing things to be prepared for each new phase, but I feel ahead of it now instead of behind it. I look forward to it, actually. I got this one. And you can always count on me. I promise. I love being your mom and figuring out what you need. Even if what you need is your independence sometimes and for me not to dance around the room. But I will not stop. I will just have my instincts sharp and ready to know what the moment requires and have a large arsenal from which to pull. I am so relieved that you are big and strong now. You're not a tiny, fragile baby, but you are still my cub, and I will protect you like a fierce bear. We are both growing together in very different ways, and I am so proud of you. You have aced a lot of milestones already, and we are just swimming upstream together, holding hands. Well, holding hands when you want to, because sometimes you just want to do it by yourself without my constant hugs and kisses all over you. I can't help it. I love you in the way where you discover the most selfless true love that one can experience. You are the keeper of my heart, the love of my life. You are just trying to figure it all out right now, but the truth is I can't wait till you will just collapse in my arms and stay for a while. Like forever. The Seagull. I am the seagull. That's my nickname. I stare at other people's plates with jealousy and curiosity. My eyes are like lasers on a target to everyone's food, and this is why. When I was at grade school, at about 7 years old, my mother kind of forgot to pack my lunches sometimes because she didn't realize that she needed to. I was fed at work, too, so this was just an honest mistake and oversight. Someone else usually took care of it, like when I was in preschool through second grade at Fountain Day School. They provided meals, hot and cold. They had macaroni and cheese, canned beets, black olives. You could put one on each finger and then make funny hand gestures with them and eat them one by one off your fingers. Lunch was a happy time where each kid got food, and we sat there at long lunch tables. It was in a shaded area under a roof, and there was a cool breeze. It was so pleasant. There was harmony and order. And everyone got the same thing, so there was no coveting or competition. We wore uniforms, too, so again, even playing field for everyone. Fountain Day School was a very quaint little school in West Hollywood and was owned by a nice woman who lived above the property. I liked it there. I felt safe. It was my first experience in school, so I didn't have anything to compare it to. They had a little swimming pool and little swim meets. They would pick one girl and one boy to be the king and queen every year, which was weird. They would ride up and down the length of the pool on blow-up swans. It was definitely a taste in jealousy for girls. It not only hit the Pavlovian princess fetish, but you got to ride a swan. I don't know what it did for boys, but I do know that our school environment affects so much of how we develop. It provides our first social experiences in life, and they are more than formative. Some are everlasting. Cut to the new format at the country school in Sherman Oaks in the Valley. This was a dog-eat-dog world. Older kids, no uniforms, and kids were defined by their clothes. They were ruthless towards each other. This was the beginning of cliques, too, so you knew your place in the food chain very fast. Speaking of food, the lunch area was like the Chicago Stock Exchange. When the bell rang, the insanity began. Lunches were commodities, packed by parents, so there was a total hierarchy on who had nicer presentation or who had better content. Peter has a ding-dong and Rachel has a Capri Sun. Let the bidding begin. It was total chaos as each kid sized each other's lunch up, and it became important if someone had a lunchbox or a brown bag. Brown bag was amateur and spit on, and a lunchbox was like driving up in a Ferrari. Some parents put their kids' lunches together with care. And some parents just threw shit together like their hair was on fire. But it was all blood sport at these lunch tables, and the major game was trade. For example, Jacob would turn to Peter and say, "Peter, I'll give you my peanut butter sandwich and some chips in a Ziploc bag for your ding-dong." Peter would just look at this kid as if to say, "In your dreams, you Ziploc-toting piece of shit. If you had a brand name bag of chips, we might have a deal, but as for today, keep drooling." It was unappetizing and terrifying. And unfortunately, since my mom was not used to providing meals, I was not in a good bargaining position most of the time. I had nothing to barter with, and I would stare at these kids' lunches because they had something and I didn't. It bothered me less that I had an absentee father than it did that I was not in the lunch game. As I sat there watching all these kids eat and trade and work their sick magic on one another, it reached a fever pitch in my life and truly affected me. I became the seagull. Staring eyes. Hungry. Darwinian. Too prideful to beg, and yet I had to develop a swooping in approach and get anything. I would suss out my prey and sidle up. "Oh, Peter, it looks like you're not finishing that ding-dong. Can I have it?" Or, Sammy, I noticed you have a turkey sandwich. You know, I've never tasted turkey before. Sammy would just look at me like, I don't give a shit. But I would survive. Each day, I took a different tactic with a different kid, and I got my scraps. Don't worry. It built character. It was a power struggle I suppose we were meant to have. Everyone knew what their leverage was that day. Some days when a kid would unwrap an aluminum triangle and reveal a piece of last night's pizza, he might as well have produced the Hope Diamond. Everyone would race over and start bidding. Mayhem all over again! Of course, that kid would either reap half the goodies from the entire group, or he would just sit there and eat it, exaggerating each bite and taunting.